Welcome to the Product Podcast by Product School. Here's a preview of today's talk.
Don't be data-driven. I think we've way over-indexed on being data-driven and just kind of blindly following data. This past weekend, I was just walking through the streets and someone had a shirt that says, "I am data-driven." And I was like, I didn't actually do this, but I was like, well, you're psychologically driven, you're socially driven, you're biologically driven, you're culturally driven, but you're not data-driven. And so I think that's important. Like, people use products because we're humans, right? And how we think about ourselves and social aspects is why we use products. Data should be used as like a point of, like a seed, a beginning point to ask a question about. So I may look at some data and go, oh, that's interesting. Like, this number is higher than this number, let's say. I'm comparing two things. Why is that the case? Like, I'm not going to just make a decision, go, oh, we should take this path or make this decision. We should go, okay, why is this the case? And then kind of dig into the reasons. And what you'll have to do is go out and kind of talk to somebody behind that. And then, so even though you started with data, you've understood, okay, I understand the why behind kind of the data that I'm looking at. And this data, okay, now it makes sense. This data actually validates the kind of the reason that I've uncovered or the insight that I've uncovered.
In this podcast, we teach our listeners valuable lessons about product management and transform them into thinking like a product manager. We teach product management, coding, data analytics, and blockchain in 14 campuses worldwide, including San Francisco, New York, and Seattle. You can find more information at productschool.com. Join our Slack community of 25,000 professionals to network and stay tuned for our upcoming events.
So just for some of the new people that walked in, we have a small group. We can just be very intimate. If you have questions, it's like things come up, just raise your hand and we'll just talk about it, about your own specific instance or your own specific work. I think that'll kind of get the benefit for everybody here. So how many people have heard of Off the Grid? Okay, food trucks, that's right, yes. So we're going to be talking about today kind of what is your favorite food truck is one question we're going to explore. But really kind of getting into the question of how good PMs answer very simple questions. I think this is actually probably the most important thing as a product manager is the question of why and how we get to that answer and what really drives people to use a product, to buy a product, and to engage with a product. And it doesn't matter if you're product marketing or product. I think this is if you can get to this answer, you'll be very effective. For people that are looking for jobs, looking for PM jobs, I would say this is going into an interview, just asking some of these, like along the lines of these questions, I guarantee you the interview won't know the answer. And in all the companies I've ever worked for, the CEO doesn't even know the answer to most of these questions. And being curious and engaged about them and intrigued about them, what I think makes good PMs. And so it's a good way to show that kind of you're thinking along the right lines of how to be successful. Okay, so just a little bit about Off the Grid if you don't know it. So we do kind of three different things. What most people are familiar with is the public markets. We have about 25 public markets. Our biggest one is Fort Mason Center every Friday nights. Presidio Picnic is on Sundays in the Presidio. We have a lot of markets that are in downtown Financial District, Fifth and Minna, Vallejo in front, some kind of just business lunches, what we call them. So that's kind of one aspect of the business. The other aspect of the business is private catering. So if someone comes to us and they want a launch party or a holiday party or even kind of a bigger wedding, we'll do private catering with food trucks for them. And then we also do corporate food service. So these are big companies that have food service programs like a Facebook or a Google. We kind of supplement some of their cafes with mobile food service programs in the form of food trucks. So a lot of people ask me like, okay, what does product have to do with Off the Grid? Like, are you making burgers and stuff? Like, no, we actually do about 3,000 events over these three business lines every year. And so we've invested in software to help optimize and manage the multiple events that we do. Okay, but first I want to get into a story before we kind of get into the meat of the talk. I was traveling in Indonesia, actually the Southeast Asia, a couple years ago for 6 months. And I met someone who's doing this nonprofit work in a place called the Banda Islands. And so you can see here's kind of Singapore. You know, this is all Indonesia here. And then here in the middle of nowhere, the most remote place I've ever been is called the Banda Islands. It was about maybe five or six kind of islands in a cluster. And they were doing marine kind of cleanup there. And I wanted to learn how to dive. They had a dive shop. And so I went and I lived on the islands for 2 months. And so this is a kind of a photo of the islands. 20 villages kind of spread out through all those five islands. Very self-sustaining culture. You know, ate off the land. They obviously had no connection kind of with the rest of the world. You know, and as kind of technology developed and they became more connected, they were introduced to plastic. And so this was a big problem. And one of the reasons that I went there was to help deal with their plastic issue. So before plastic was invented, they would just use banana leaves as their, you know, form of bags or wrappers. And you just take the banana leaves and you just throw it in the ocean, right? And so then plastic came in, and the behavior, of course, doesn't change, right? So they take the wrapper and they just throw it in the ocean. And that was like destroying the coral, destroying the ocean. And the dive shop there was not happy about this pollution. And so there was a big effort to clean it up. The whole island, it was pretty sad because there was just trash everywhere. This is like fish that's being dried in the sun, and you can see it just kind of trash all underneath. You know, in the markets, it was all in the water. And so the nonprofit had this original solution, which they had made some progress of, like, they established like a recology process so that people would every once a week put their trash out in these sacks, and then they actually got a dump truck. It was like a small, I would say it was the size of maybe like a Fiat, but a truck form, very small. And it would go around the villages and pick up the trash once a week and put it in the dump. So they calculated, okay, we're like putting 2.5 tons of trash in this dump every year. We need an incinerator, and we're going to burn the trash, and that's how we'll manage this trash problem. So I came along, and I kind of said, well, okay, well, what are people throwing away? And like no one could answer the question. They're like, well, we think it's this, but it might be this. Well, I bet it's that. And I was like, well, let's just go ask the people what they're going to throw away. So we went around, and you know, I didn't speak Indonesian, so we had someone that kind of went around to each house, and we literally just went and we asked them, you know, this is kind of like the site name. They had rough house numbers. We'd actually go up and like ask them, you know, are you house 002? And they'd be like, yeah, I guess I am house 002. Because they never had to have an address, you know, to get mail or anything. And so we went and collected like the weight of the bag that they threw away, and then just some notes, and then we kind of just chit-chatted with them. Did this for, I don't know, maybe 50 or so different houses and guest houses and restaurants. And what you can see, starting on the left, is like what they're throwing away. You know, there's bags and there's plastic, but it's branches, it's leaves, it's dirt, it's rocks. So we collected all this data, and I just threw it in an Excel sheet. And so if you look at all the trash that the villagers were throwing away, 78% of it is just organic matter. They're literally like sweeping up dirt and rocks and leaves and then a couple of pieces of plastic and throwing it in a bag and then putting it out for the garbage people to come by. A very small amount of it was the kind of inorganic stuff. And you know, that's kind of what's shown over here is the plastic pieces, plastic bags, and water, these little tiny water cups that all the kids liked. So, you know, we asked them, why are you throwing away dirt and sticks and leaves? And they would say, oh, we were told to. Like, that's what, you know, people came around, they said, don't throw anything in the ocean, sweep it all up, and put all your trash on the side of the road. And so they were just following the instructions that they were told. And so kind of throughout this process, we realized, okay, maybe we don't need to buy an incinerator and burn all the trash. We just need to educate them on organic versus inorganic matter. I mean, these people aren't educated like we are. And so they don't know the difference that, you know, a leaf is going to biodegrade in the ocean and a plastic knot. It's just a wrapper to them. So kind of we presented this information, and kind of this is our revised solution. So educate the villagers. The two pieces of inorganic matter that were making it to the island were plastic bags and these plastic cups. So we said, well, how can we reduce those getting in? That would just kind of reduce the raw amount of those two pieces of plastic, and then hopefully we'll have less trash. So anyway, what we got to was like, let's not buy an incinerator for $20,000. Let's try to solve these problems first, and then we can kind of reevaluate if we should buy an incinerator. So how does this apply to building great products? So the first is asking our customers or something about your product, what just simple questions. So I simply asked, well, what are people throwing away? And I didn't really have a good answer. So we went out and found that answer. And we did that by just going and asking people. Like, we didn't, you know, just go and collect data. We asked people, and then we kind of validated what we found with data. We asked why a lot. So we were, you know, told, like, we just were told not to throw anything in the ocean, and kind of really dug into the reasons behind why they were behaving in such ways. And then one piece which I'm going to harp on is kind of collecting data to validate kind of your insights that you gather, as opposed to maybe the other way around, which I think happens a lot in San Francisco, you know, Silicon Valley, is we have these data and then we pull insights out of the data. And I sometimes think it's backwards. So this is what we're going to take away, some takeaways for today. So the simple questions kind of really matter the most. I think a lot of times we can get wrapped up in kind of very complex questions or complex analysis, but really, like, humans are very simple creatures. We just want simple tools to help us do simple things. And so if a product can do that really, really well, then people will adopt it and people will pay for it. Observe firsthand and then validate with data. I'll give some examples on that. And then kind of two frameworks that I like to use, and I encourage my team to use, is ask five whys, and I'll explain what that is, and then the jobs to be done theory. Has anyone heard of that, jobs to be done? Raise your hand if you haven't heard of it. Okay, cool, so a few people. Okay, two major pitfalls before we get into that stuff, and I think they're kind of especially prevalent here in the Valley. So the first is, don't be data-driven. I think we've way over-indexed on being data-driven and just kind of blindly following data. This past weekend, I was just walking through the streets and someone had a shirt that says, I am data-driven. And I was like, I didn't actually do this. But I was like, well, you're psychologically driven, you're socially driven, you're biologically driven, you're culturally driven, but you're not data-driven. And so I think that's important. Like, people use products because we're humans, right? And how we think about ourselves and social aspects is why we use products. So this is an example here is offthegrid.com, our main website. You know, 96% of our traffic is from the United States. So a lot of our marketing efforts and kind of the themes that we do are all marketed locally on, you know, social channels and email and what have you. But when we actually went out and talked to the people at the markets, about 50% of one particular market, the Fort Mason Center, they're from out of town. They're tourists, or they're there because somebody else is from out of town. So all this kind of time and effort we're putting into promoting and marketing on Instagram, which is San Francisco followers, goes nowhere when people are coming from not the Bay Area, right? And so, you know, the kind of the misleading piece here is the traffic is 96% of the United States because they come here on their phone, right, and their IP address is here in the United States. This kind of gives it away that 44% or 95% are new users. So they're new because they're just coming here for the first time. And so, you know, we can kind of look at this and go and follow it and make decisions off of it. But I much prefer this strategy of go talk to people and then validate with the data. So the second thing is get off Slack. Daniel Novak, who works for me, knows that I preach this a lot. You know, the Golden Gate Bridge was built, they didn't have Slack, 1933. Built in 4 years, not too bad. The jet engine was built in 1942, they didn't have Slack, not too bad. Working like in being a product manager, like, don't be on Slack, get out of your chair and walk outside and go talk to your customers. And I know it's like really, really hard. I have a challenge at it too. But like, that is what you're being paid to do, is go talk to your customers and understand them better than they understand themselves. Okay, so some of the questions that we're asking at Off the Grid, we're actually like right in the middle of this big kind of user survey, which is it's actually perfect timing kind of for this talk. So we don't actually have results yet, but I can talk about some of the nuances and kind of where we are in our thinking. So we went out and we have 150 different surveys that we talked to, and talked to 150 people across all of our markets. And ask, you know, why are you coming here? And at first you may go, oh, well, you know, people need something to eat, right? They're just coming for food. Well, it's much more nuanced than that. And actually, for the most part, people aren't coming for something to eat. They're coming for a lot of different things. And so something to do and see. So this is a lot of tourists. It's an event. It's an attraction is the reason they come, to be a part of the community. we have a market in the East Bay with the Oakland Museum called OMCA, and a lot of people there are really from the local area and part of the community, and kind of the museum bolsters that. And so people aren't coming to eat, people are coming to kind of be a part of where they live in that local scene. You have the foodies, so there are people that come and just want to discover new foods. This is an interesting one where parents can let their kids run wild. So if you know, a mom and have a couple kids that are crazy, you don't want to go into a restaurant, you're sick of cooking at home for them, and so where can you go where there's a bunch of different food, they can drop it on the ground, and they can run around. Like that's, we provide that environment. Grab and go, so a lot of our business lunches, like people want to, unfortunately, probably go and go back on Slack. But they kind of in and out. It's very, very transactional. And I found kind of these two go a little bit together of the kind of a break in the day. So a lot of companies that I could go downstairs and go to the cafe or get delivery, like that's very quick grab and go, but they don't choose that option because they want to get outside. They want a break from their day. And so kind of going out for even 5 minutes, getting some fresh air, getting a quick lunch and going back is meeting a very specific need. Then a lot of people just come because it's a weekly ritual. They just come because it's Wednesday, and that's what they do at Off the Grid. So it's a kind of a habitual habit or behavior. Okay, another question that I like to ask is, why do people, if Off the Grid didn't exist, what would they choose as an alternative? And I actually encourage you to ask this about your product. If you know my product doesn't exist, what would you use instead? And see what they answer, and then kind of ask why. And what the differences are. So alternatives to Off the Grid that we found are dinner at home, getting food delivery, or even a park. And this really speaking to like the community aspect of where do you go to feel a part of the community? You go to a park in your local neighborhood. And so then compared to these things, why are they choosing Off the Grid? I think the kind of convenience is an aspect of it. And then kind of an answer of like what I can't do on my own. So because people are choosing to cook at home versus go to Off the Grid, if they can't make a certain type of cuisine or don't know how, then they'll go to Off the Grid and get one of our diverse options. So how do we decide what to eat? When people show up, there's maybe at times 30 different food vendors. How do we choose which one? Many, I would say most, as humans are, we're very habitual creatures, so we kind of go to the same one. What is very interesting with this question is people say, oh, I love Off the Grid because you have such a diversity of food, you have such variety. And then we'll ask, oh, well, have you tried every one? And they're like, nope, I just go to Senior Sysig every time. I'm like, okay. So don't just believe what they say, dig into their actions, and that's really kind of their true motivation. And then shortest line in dietary restrictions. Some other answers that we get. Okay, so kind of talking about like two customer insights frameworks. We'll start with the five whys and then jobs to be done. So five whys is pretty self-explanatory. It's like a nagging child. Just ask why five times in a row. And you can get to some pretty like emotional places with this. So I'll give an example, and then maybe we'll try it here with either a product that you have or why you're actually here tonight. But this is something I actually found online. I think it's really interesting. So at the Jefferson Memorial, the stone was deteriorating off the kind of outside of the building. So the engineers asked five whys. So they first asked, okay, well, why is the stone deteriorating? And they found out that they were using high-powered sprayers to wash the memorial every 2 weeks, which was kind of cracking and chipping off pieces of the stone. Okay, well, why are high-powered sprayers used to wash the memorial? Well, there's too much bird crap everywhere. Okay, well, why is there so much bird crap? Because they feed on all the spiders. Well, why are there so many spiders? It's because they feed on all the insects. Well, why are there so many insects? Because they keep the lights on all night long. So the solution to their problem was to turn the lights off. And so they just reduced the lights at night, and they solved the problem. They didn't wash nearly as frequently, and they got the benefit of they saved electricity out of it too. And so I thought like a very interesting problem where the five whys is a good solution. Okay, jobs to be done. So kind of a quick kind of an overview of what this actually is. So it's kind of a lens or a framework to look through how people hire a product. And it's kind of maybe a different language using when talking about user research. So customers hire products to do certain jobs. So we don't necessarily buy products or engage with products, but we hire them. And there can be many products to do for kind of a very specific job. And so kind of I put some examples here, and I'll kind of talk through each one. So I hire a fork to help me eat food. I hire a suitcase to help me carry my belongings when I travel. And I hire Lyft to help me get to a destination. So let's look at the first one. So the job that I have to do is to eat my food, and I hire a fork to do that. So there's many products that I can hire to do this job. I can hire a spoon, my hands, a spork, or even chopsticks. So why don't I hire some of these things, and why do I hire a fork? So if I'm eating spaghetti, a spoon isn't very good, right? It's just going to fall right off. So kind of, okay, there's a nuance to this. It's not just eating, it's eating spaghetti. If I use my hands, my friends will think I'm a crazy lunatic, right? Imagine just like shoving your face with your hands. So there's a social element, which is really important, why people may not use this. Now, what's interesting about this is in America. In India, you won't be thought of a crazy lunatic. That's the norm. So as you think about your product, don't think about just functional things. Think about cultural things as well. Chopsticks, so I don't know how to use chopsticks. I think there's an educational component for people. And then like a spork. It doesn't really work as good as a spoon, or it doesn't really work like a good fork. People are going to hire the best product to get their job done. All right, carry belongings when traveling. So I could use a backpack. I could use a garbage bag. Or I could ship belongings to a destination, and I just don't even have to use a suitcase in the first place. So kind of thinking through this in more detail. So a backpack is not really big enough to fit all my clothes. A garbage bag, it's not really organized, it easily rips. People might judge me. This is, again, like what is the kind of emotional and social aspects of these products. Although if you do go to Asia, like people just shove stuff in garbage bags and boxes and whatever they can find, and they'll just kind of throw it in the overhead bin in airplanes. So, you know, different culture, different kind of social elements. And this last one, kind of like, it's kind of a pain. It's not very convenient. It's probably more expensive. But it actually might be an interesting product. So like imagine creating a solution where you didn't have to carry a suitcase and you actually went to your destination and just rented the clothes there. So I thought that was kind of an interesting avenue.
If you have enjoyed the episode so far, check out our upcoming live events at productschool.com/events. Use the promo code PRODUCTPODCAST in all caps to get a free ticket to the next event in your city.
Okay, final one. So getting to a destination. So I personally use Lyft. Certainly there's many products that can do this job. So walking, bicycle, public transit, driving, and then its competitor. So walking, you know, getting to a destination, all destinations are different. If it's close, I'm going to walk. If it's far, I don't want to be tired. So for a bicycle, let's say I'm going on a date and I don't want to get all sweaty. So there's kind of an aspect of not just the job to be done of getting to the destination, but like the context around that. So when thinking about this with your product, like what, it's not just like the functional aspect they're trying to do, like what is the kind of broader context in which they're working and in which they're using your product. So I hate waiting for the subway. There's personal preference in here. So driving, it'll take me too long. So there's a convenience aspect in here. And then Uber, you know, I don't like Uber. So there's kind of a brand identity in here. And I, you know, this is where like brand and product kind of, it matters. So all these things, like for me personally, this is kind of the areas that I choose and hire Lyft to do a job. So kind of just a summary of the framework. Define the very specific job customers are trying to solve. This can be very nuanced. So ask a lot of questions and get the context. Don't think about just the functional components. Think about the emotional and cultural aspects of the context and what they're trying to do. Understand the alternative products that they're hiring to do the job. A lot of times people will think, oh, this is my competitor. But like going back to Lyft, like Uber is not Lyft's competitor. It's one competitor, but there's kind of all of these other ones. And I think a lot of people just look at what's the most direct competitor. But in a customer's mind, they're just trying to solve their problem. They don't care about like what the market says or what the industry is. They just want something that's going to solve their problem. And so kind of thinking through this entire like holistic context can help you come up with some insightful ideas. Yeah, so I mean, what I think, you know, what I've seen and what good PMs do well is they answer the simple questions, observe first, and then validate with data, and then kind of ask why a lot. So just some starting points for you, kind of based on kind of these topics. So why do customers use your product? We talked a lot about that. What is their real motivation? Who is your super customer? So like identifying this person or persona and understanding why they're your super customer, and also kind of as valuable as just understanding your kind of non-customer, someone who doesn't engage a lot, and why they don't do so. What are your customers doing right before they use their product? And then what do they do right after? Like what is the context that they're doing in the environment that they're doing in when they choose, oh, I need to use XYZ? How often do your customers use your product? And how often should they use it? One of the things that I kind of fall in this trap sometimes is like, oh, we need more engagement. Like we want our customer to use our product more. Well, that's not always the case. You want them to use it when they need to use it. So like an Airbnb, they don't want me to use Airbnb every week or every day. They want me to use it 3 times a year when I travel, especially globally, and I need a place to stay. And so when that happens and they know that I'm doing that, you know, if you've like ever like gone on Airbnb or like looked at a place or favorited a place, they will incessantly email you. Like, okay, now we've got you. This is the time when we want you to use your product. We want you to book a place to stay with us. We want you to do activities with us. We want you to eat with us all during that time. A Facebook is more of like an hourly thing. They want you to use the product every hour. It's a good weekly. Maybe like Google Maps, you'd use on a weekly basis. If you're trying to go out to dinner or you know, going to someplace you haven't been before. So kind of understanding when customers should use your product can help you focus and cut out a lot of crap that you may not need. And then, yeah, if your product didn't exist, where would they turn to use it as an alternative and why? So these are just some books that I've come across in the past that kind of speak to, you know, the whys, the psychology behind human and decision-making. Behavioral economics are kind of a theme that runs through all of these. This first one, Clayton Christensen, you know, he made the disruption theory famous 20 years ago. But this book specifically talks about the job to be done theory and how it's applied in business. This one is really behavioral economics and humans are just habitual creatures. This one, I don't know if you've read this one, but like from a product marketing perspective, this is like a staple. How people think about industries and kind of they talk about ladders in people's head and where companies kind of fall on that ladder. And then the person in the situation is really good. It's kind of what it's talking about is people don't make decisions. Actually, the environment is really what drives our decision making. A good example from this book is they emailed a campus or a college, and they said, like, we have this food donation at, you know, building A or whatever. And they got, you know, 15% people to donate based on the email list. And then they sent the exact same email with just the map with building A with an X on it. And, like, the engagement doubled. And so kind of helping people understand, oh, like, this is the environment. You know, it's easier for me to make a decision because they just showed me a picture of, you know, where building A is. And, of course, I know where building A is, but they're reducing the kind of friction, the mental friction that I have to go through to make my decision. And so if you can create an environment where people don't have to think, they can just kind of follow the path, you'll kind of see more engagement that way. Yeah, so that's it. If we have any questions, we can kind of dive into some specific examples if you'd like to. Yeah. Totally. I mean, I think the product manager is responsible for knowing the answer. They can use resources to go and get that answer, but like they should be responsible for understanding what it is. And if that means kind of going to the customer and asking them directly, then I think that's what you should do. But if you have a good user research team and a good UX team, then kind of helping them understand the goals is how maybe you can help shape other teams to go and do that. Yeah.
Great presentation. From what you've explained here, it looks like a lot of your time goes into turning customer behavior into insights.
Mm-hmm.
How much of your time goes into this, and how much of your time goes into more execution?
Good question. I guess it depends. It depends on kind of where you are in either your company stage or like your product stage. So for the off the grid kind of work we're doing right now, we had a mobile app and we were just focused on other things, other kind of pieces of software. And the mobile app was just like, we're just like, okay, we don't even have enough time right now to think about it. But when it's now we're kind of thinking about, okay, we want a strategy of our guest strategy, of our mobile app strategy. Like the first step of that strategy should be, what are we solving for? Like what is the motivation of people kind of engaging with off the grid? So at the beginning of any new kind of, I would say major strategy, I would take this kind of holistic approach. And then from there, like, okay, this is our product strategy. Now as you get into features, I think you can have a kind of a similar line of questioning, but on a more kind of specific scale. So like whenever you're, I would say, building something new, this presentation was a bit more holistic on like, you know, what is our product strategy? Did that answer your question?
Yeah, absolutely. It's good to talk it into product strategy.
Yeah. And I think like you can say like, we're in research phase and we want to answer these questions. That research phase has an endpoint, right? So we want to get to answer those questions, and then now we have the insights. Now we're going to move into, you know, kind of either UX or feasibility stage. Yeah, it depends on, you know, for the revenue cost. Like it depends on what your company strategy is. If, you know, if you're trying to make money, then obviously. If you're trying to have some other objective, then you know, that's what you'd focus on. The persona one is a trick. It's the art in this, I would say. This isn't all science. The how you slice that personas is tough. I would look for patterns. I would say you'd be like, oh, this person and the person I talked with last week and the person, we talked with yesterday, they're all kind of similar. And like, what makes them similar? If you can identify that, that's how I would shape that persona. A lot of times it will be the motivation, but like the busy mom isn't like really a motivation. It's kind of more of a demographic. And they're similar in how they behave. And I guess it is a motivation because they come to off the grid for the same reasons, which is to let their kids run free and run wild. But that motivation plus like who they are and kind of who they are, you know, are as a person in the community, the kind of the more specific you can get, the better. Yeah. But what you don't want is you don't want 13 personas. I think, and it's what you guys did. You said, oh, we have 13. Okay, like, this is too many. How can we either kind of make it a bit more broad to kind of shrink it down? Because at the end of the day, you want something that's actionable. You want to say, okay, I understand this user. I can put a face and a personality behind it and a motivation behind it. And then that can help me go and build for it. Yeah.
How do you test for a person's ability to excel at this type of customer discovery?
Good question. I have thought about.
Aside from experience.
Yeah, I have. I don't think it's you can't do it with experience. I think it's a kind of a personality. I was actually thinking on my bike ride over here, like an investigative journalist would be like a perfect person for this. They're curious. So it's a mindset more than it is like a skill set. Does that make sense? So someone that's naturally curious and is kind of like digging to try to like weave and find an answer with someone who can like engage with somebody, that's somebody who's going to be good at this. Somebody who's more maybe analytical or technical, not a social, would not be good. But someone who asks why, who asks questions, I would start there. Yeah.
I'm interested in your point about data-driven.
Yes.
Because I mean, I understand what you were explaining, mm-hmm. but can you elaborate a bit more about how, like, the ways that you would
deal with kind of people? Yes. So maybe I was a bit aggressive. I just don't want to throw it off a cliff. But data should be used as like a point of, like a seed, a beginning point, to ask a question about. So I may look at some data and go, oh, that's interesting. Like this number is higher than this number, let's say. I'm comparing two things. Why is that the case? Like I'm not going to just make a decision and go, oh, we should take this path or make this decision. We should go, okay, why is this the case? And then kind of dig into the reasons. And what you'll have to do is go out and kind of talk to somebody behind that. And then, so even though you started with data, you've understood, okay, I understand the why behind kind of the data that I'm looking at. And this data, okay, now it makes sense. This data actually validates the kind of the reason that I've uncovered or the insight that I've uncovered. So whenever I see data, I'm always skeptical. One thing, if you ever kind of look at data, ask how the data was collected. Like, go to the source, and you will learn a tremendous amount about what that data is really telling you. Just too often, people look at data, and they just kind of run with it and take it at face value, and it will, most of the time, I would say it probably lead you in the wrong direction, unless you kind of, like, really understand the context behind how it's being collected. Even just one person is well, you'll have tremendous insight. We try to do whenever we have a feature idea or whatever, we'll always call a customer, even just to pitch them the idea, you know. And then if we can show designs, great. But just pitching them the idea, they'll come back and, you know, just talking through it, like, they'll give you a perspective that you just don't have, because unless you are have lived in the industry for a while, oftentimes as product managers, like, it's a new industry, something that's not your area of expertise. Food and food trucks certainly is not mine. And so I don't know their mindset and where they're coming from, but just one conversation, it's always an aha for me. It's always like, oh, you know, they think about this totally different. Like, we were doing it wrong. We need to do it this way. And even just, you know, within 1 minute, you'll kind of have that perspective, which is critical. Yeah. I don't know. It's different in every case. I would say make an assumption, be like, and test your assumption. And that's kind of like the MVP, like, theory of, like, okay, I'm going to make this product or I'm going to make this feature and it's going to have this impact. It's going to do this. And try to make that as detailed as possible. And then go and test it. And I think a lot of times you can test with just, you know, UX design files. Like, Envision has the kind of prototype tool where you can kind of do click-throughs. Even just that and giving it to someone, you can already start to see, like, is my assumption right or is my assumption wrong? But, like, before you even start designing anything, we have a pretty, off the grid, a kind of a pretty rigorous, like, product requirements, you know, process. So we spell everything out, all the success metrics out beforehand, and say, okay, this is the value we're trying to deliver on. And then through the whole design process, like, we're always checking back to that and making, okay, is this validating what our initial thoughts were? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I guess, you know, the launches for me, I maybe early in my career, was, like, scary, like, oh, here we go, like, going to push the button. But I've gotten to the point where launches are kind of, like, the boring part, because, like, all the fun part happened 6 months ago, doing the user interviews and doing the designs and, like, thinking through the tough questions. Maybe the scariest part for me now is, like, testing before launch, because that's when, like, you know, if you really effed up in QAing stuff. So for actually launch, yeah, so the video, launch for me is more about promotion than it is about, and kind of marketing and education, than it is about, like, you know, the product, launching the product. Like, at this point, we know it should work. Like, we know it's going to get out there. It's going to function. It's about, how do we educate and how we get people hyped up about it. So one thing I do, what Daniel was referring to is payments. We had this big kind of feature where we were taking online payments at Off the Grid. It was a big 6-month-long development effort. And so I made a video of, like, Off the Grid used to take cash, and, like, we had cash machines, and we're actually counting cash with, like, the Brinks thing would come up. And so I made a video showing, like, the before and after, and sent it around, and everyone got a chuckle out of it, and you know, we can all celebrate over it. Yeah.
You think that you'll get a good interview out of that person?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, like a methodical randomization.
Yeah.
One thing I it's kind of a mental exercise I do. A lot of I feel like a lot of times in the Bay Area, people design products for people in the Bay Area, which is, like, the least, you know, representative, like, place in the whole world. I call it the airplane test. So if you're walking down an aisle when you're getting on an airplane, like, everyone's in their seats, look at each person in the face and go, will this person use my product? Because it's a nice shuffling. Maybe not departing out of San Francisco, but, like, anywhere else in the world, you can do this, and it's interesting because you'll have ideas of your customers that you've never thought about before. Again, kind of, we're naturally biased about how we think about things, and I think we do that as product managers with, like, who our customers are. And so when I walk in, I'm like, oh, well, that person used my product, like, oh, they're 65, you know, they have a cane, like, oh, I didn't think about that, you know, should they be using my product? And so it will help you think about, like, who your target customer segment is. Yeah. Cool. Well, thank you very much, and good luck with your products.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to the Product Podcast. If you liked this episode, don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes. If you want to know more about our courses and next courts, visit productschool.com. Stay tuned for the next episode to learn more about the secrets in product management.